Welcome to the Movies on the Brain podcast. I am one of your hosts, Brian C. Wood. With me tonight is my co-host, as always,
Chad Mitz.
Welcome to another weird, wild, and wacky week in the world of genre movie news. As me and Chad broadcast live from the cozy and somewhat spacious apartment that is currently occupied by a giant Christmas tree. Yes, folks, I am back home, and it is a wonderful feeling. So, Chad has been away at the magical land of Disney, and we had some technical difficulties during the period of time between before Thanksgiving and after Thanksgiving of hooking up and getting a podcast done, so we have a good bit of news to talk about, not the least of which is the fact that Doctor Strange is now one of the highest-grossing original solo movies that Marvel has put out. They are now just behind, sitting at $209 million domestically. They're sitting right behind the original Iron Man, which ended up at 280-something, 282, 289, something like that, domestically. So, Chad, your thoughts on the fact that Doctor Strange isn't just going to do Ant-Man money, isn't just going to do Thor the Dark World money, but could end up doing Iron Man money by the time all is said and done?
I think that's... I don't know if I would say I expected that, but that's nothing but good news. I mean, it's for what we're talking about. He's an obscure character dealing with things that are not traditional for superhero movies. Comic book fans, not all comic book fans necessarily like the character, and he's going to do Iron Man money. I think it's a combination of people actually liking the movie, liking the character, and, you know, it's Marvel. So, you slap Marvel on it, it's going to make some money. I'd be anxious to know how much they actually expected it to do. I don't think they're disappointed. I just want to kind of know if they thought it would do this well or do, you know, like Ant-Man. Because I would say Ant-Man is, I'll put Ant-Man a little bit above Doctor Strange and what I would expect from a movie financially wise, but...
Well, I think when you add the power of the batch to anything, anything will do better. But, this is Feige's baby. This is the one that he has been promoting for a long time and the one that he's wanted to do forever. And they got it pretty much right. And it's got a charm to it that a lot of people enjoy. No pun intended. And it's been... remarkable, really, to see that even with Fantastic Beasts opening shortly after it, that it's been able to maintain and have some legs and make some good money. I think the fact that it opened in the 80s, as far as $80 million range for an opening, is very solid. Mm-hmm. I think the fact that it's maintained that, and it's going to end up somewhere around 8 or 9, which out of 14 movies being mid-pack is...
Pretty good
for a character who deals in the mystic arts.
Yeah.
So it pretty much all but guarantees that, you know, of course we knew he would pop up in Thor Ragnarok, but it almost guarantees that we will have that Doctor Strange 2 coming in 2020 because, you know, the bill always comes due.
Oh, I forgot about you and that tagline. If they don't use that tagline, how upset are you gonna be?
Well, it has to be like the first thing Mordo utters when he sees Strange for the first time.
It can't be the very first thing off his mouth. It's got to be like they meet and then they do whatever, and then at the end when he's leaving, he's like, "The bill always comes due," and then he goes away.
Yes,
and,
yeah. See, that works. That works as long as you actually pay the line off. Although I'm fairly certain Scott Derrickson and who the other writers on this iteration of Doctor Strange probably didn't intend on, like, that line being a thing.
Oh, so, no, I can... I'm pretty sure they did.
Yes, but as corny and as cheesy and as so 1990s as that line is...
Very much is, all of that.
Yeah, I really, really would like it if they paid that off. If nothing else, for a laugh.
I don't think anybody else is going to remember but you.
I'll
remember now.
Yeah, it's repeated like 4 times in that final segment. He's like, "The bill comes due, Strange. We cannot continue to do these things. Our magical abilities are being used for not good things. There are rules and consequences.
The way he's played up and the way everything is evolved, it actually makes sense for him to say that and probably say that, like, fairly early. So, it wouldn't...
Well, because that's going to be the whole bit, really, between Mordo and Strange is going to be, you know, magic has a price. And part of that price is altering timelines. But magic always has a price. So it's the butterfly effect. For every action, there is an equal or greater reaction, you know. The Back to the Future Part 2 scenario under which, you know, you change one thing, you change everything.
Unless you need the DeLorean to go back to where it came from, at which point that doesn't change. But again, here, this is me and my personal hatred of time travel. And my hatred of... To think that I don't like time travel and I don't like magic, and both of those things are in this movie, and I kind of like this movie, that's fine. But if we talk about it too much, then I realize...
Which is why the very first thing I brought up on our Doctor Strange podcast was the fact that now they have the ability to rewind time. Interesting side note, Derrickson has said on the press tour subsequently that one of the reasons he did the bit in Hong Kong was because he wanted to have... play up, you know, go against type, against the trope. Whereas normally a superhero battle is destroying an entire city.
Yeah.
This way he wanted the finale to kind of rebuild an entire city. Kind of wanted to play against type there. But yes, I mean, it's the time stone.
I was having a discussion about the time stone yesterday, and there are people that believe that, you know, once again, because it's time and the way this movie played out, it's like, well, Doctor Strange can do anything, and because it's the time zone, nothing really matters. And I'm like, well, that's true, but he can't wear the time stone all the time, because as we keep saying, you know, Vision has to lose his head. So if he's wearing the time stone all the time, he's dead. So he can't wear it all the time. I think that's the last time we'll see him wear it. Next time we see the time stone, Thanos is breaking in that joint and taking it because he cannot take it off of Doctor Strange, because then Doctor Strange is dead. So that...
Well, I think the disappointing thing for me in that scenario was really that they didn't... Wong makes it very, very clear. There are rules and consequences to using the Time Stone, but we don't see any of the consequences of using the Time Stone. So it kind of does leave the audience with the feeling that yes, he rewound time and brought all of these people in Hong Kong back to life, but there was no consequences to it.
I mean, they could pay that one forward by, you know, saying it's because he was dealing with Dormammu, blah, blah, blah. But, yeah, I guess they should pay it off. But...
Because that's where the origin of the bill always comes due, is that for every action... there is a reaction, and you will have to pay a price at some point.
Well, maybe part two is them paying the price, and we just kick that can down the road till we get to part two. I can live with it.
Well, I mean, you're kind of going to have to explain how the whole thing is used, considering it's going to have to be in the Infinity Gauntlet. And I do agree with you. Like, if you're going to destroy one stone to have it never show back up again or ever be used again, the Time Stone is it.
Oh, yeah.
Because it takes away your get-out-of-jail-free card.
That one... if it were me, after Infinity War, Time Stone would be bye-bye. But because the Eye of Amaterasu is such a big Doctor Strange thing, I can see them keeping it around. I don't think they should. It needs to go away. But I can see it because of... they've now attached an Infinity Stone to something that's deep in Doctor Strange lore.
Indeed. So let's move away from Marvel for a bit, and let's talk about a small movie that dropped while we were away. Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. Chad, you've heard reactions, you've heard people talking about this new entry in the Marvel cinema and the J.K. Rowling Wizarding World. How have you know a lot of mainstream people. How are people reacting? The ones that you know of.
For the most part, well, actually, I haven't heard anything bad about the movie. Most people most people I've seen enjoy the movie. There were like a few people that had issues, but I kind of stayed away from it because I was trying to see it. So I haven't seen it yet, but it seems to be doing fairly well, at least reception-wise. I think it's doing well financially, too, so.
So, I've seen the movie twice now. It's okay. It's not a movie, I will say this. It is not a movie. It is a movie very similar to Prisoner of
Azkaban?
No. It's a very similar movie to Chamber and Sorcerer's Stone in that those movies are, at times, borderline unwatchable because it feels kind of... If you're dealing with child actors who are being forced to carry so much of this. Fantastic Beasts is doesn't hold up on a second or third viewing because it's so predicated on the wonder and awe of seeing these things for the first time. The whole bit about the monsters, about the creatures, and the whole bit about going inside the suitcase and walking around and seeing all these things and having the nomads, Jacob, right there with everybody, being the eyes and ears and the shock and all of that, that goes away the second time and the third time around. And so you're really left with the character work. Colin Farrell does a really good job. I'll give him that, even though he's part of a plot twist there at the end. He does a really good job with what he's got. And they do a really good job with the bait and switch, a lot better than I anticipated, actually. But for J.K. Rowling, who is such a character-driven author and a character-driven storyteller, it almost... I don't have as much of an attachment to Newt as I should. And going forward, like, his story didn't resonate with me and I didn't connect with him nearly as much as Jacob. And the two girls are okay, but, like, it kind of, there's that clear line where it's like, you can see where, look, if those two girls don't show up in any other movie, I'm fine.
But is Jacob, is he the...
The kind of bigger guy.
The one that's like the equivalent of a muggle?
Yeah, the nomad, yes.
What's his name? I know his name, and I cannot think of it, but I know you're talking about.
The magic is all fun, and the ending is very intense and emotional, but, like, Constance really grabs you. For good, and that's a positive considering where the franchise is going to be going. She has a really great story arc about, the New Salem organization and their hatred of witches and wizards. She does a really good job of dealing with child abuse. And people who adopt and foster children just for the purposes of abusing them. She does a really nice and animalistic and animalistic, a really nice naturalistic theme about zoos and about creature confining and holding these creatures in and not letting them be free and roam and have their space. But her character work outside of really Constance and really Constance isn't very good. I don't feel anything for these other characters. And as a result, when we get to the fact that we know that there are four more movies coming and it's like, well, Newt will be back next time. I'm hoping you give me a little bit more shading to Redmayne's character, to Newt, because otherwise he didn't really grab me. And if all four of them come back and they're, going along this timeline, that'll be fine. Hopefully, again, we just get more development as we go along. Because as of right now, I don't really care if these characters keep going. I want to know more about the creatures. I want to see more creatures. And I want to see more of the Grindelwald Dumbledore stuff and the Constance stuff, but I don't really have a deep desire to see more about Newt Scamander.
So how much of the Dumbledore stuff did you get in this one?
Did not, no.
Nothing?
Nothing. Well, I mean, you get Grindelwald.
Okay.
And you get Grindelwald, and you get the Grindelwald twist there at the end. I'm very afraid. After just the 2.5 minutes I saw of... minute and a half I saw of Depp on screen, I'm very afraid of what he's going to do and his acting choices. My only hope for that role is he will have enough respect for the material that Rowling provides to him that he won't take too many creative liabilities with it. That he'll try to honor the intent of the author, or in this case, the screenplay writer, and work with her on his pathos and his emotions and his accent and all of those things, which Rowling is going to be very particular about. Because if we get an accent, it's kind of almost, the flashback sequence in Force Awakens where you have all the jumbled voices, mm-hmm. and you go back and you watch it 2 or 3 times to try and strain your ears to hear. It's the same way with his Grindelwald. He has a line at the end and you're kind of like, what? Like, it's almost Bane-ish in the terms of trying to hear him. So, I'm compelled by the Dumbledore Grindelwald story. I'm compelled by Newt being a side player in that. I'm compelled by the idea of these other three characters being eyes and ears as we head toward the first great Wizarding War. But I don't really care about them, and if they happen to get killed, I'm not going to be terribly sad. Let's just do the Grindelwald Dumbledore stuff and get the Dumbledore younger Dumbledore casting done right. So
it sounds like as long as the Dumbledore stuff happens throughout these movies, they should be fine.
But see, there's the problem. It's a Fantastic Beast and Where to Find Them, and at the point in which we meet Newt Scamander, he's already spent his year in the field. And he's already working on the manuscript that will become Fantastic Beast and Where to Find Them. So he gets on a boat at the end and goes back to England. We know that the next movie is in Paris about 4 to 5 years later. Why is Newt still walking around with a suitcase full of magical creatures? And because the film's really principally built around this idea of there's this really scary phenomenon that's going on. People think it's potentially a creature that's gotten loose. They've actually made laws about creature owning in America in this time period to prevent such things from happening, because everybody's very, at this point, concerned about Allie and the Statute of Secrecy and the Muggle world, or in this case, the Nomad world, finding out about wizards. So, and they've just gone through the Salem experience and all that. But the setup and the conceit of the film is basically, okay, these four creatures got loose out of the suitcase. So we've got to go hunt down and recapture those four beasts, get them back into the suitcase so that people don't have a reason to be concerned about it's these beasts that are causing this phenomenon. So if you're going to keep doing sequels, particularly 4 more sequels, my concern principally is if you take that concept and that conceit away, how does Newt really fit in going forward?
I got you. I think audiences, as long as they have the Harry Potter ties, they're fine. And they're going from America to Paris, so you give them new locations within Harry Potter, and it's something new for them.
But there's also disappointments. We didn't see the American Wizarding School. We get it name dropped, and we see flashes of newspaper headlines. We don't get to visit it. And so, if we're going to Paris, or we're not gonna see Beauxbatons. If we go to Barcelona, we're not gonna see Durmstrang. Like, there are elements there that could really, even the American Congress, Magical Congress, the building. There's a lot there to see and explore that you could have done. There are things about the Harry Potter mythos that get looked at because you spend so much time in Hogwarts. Mm-hmm. You get those things hinted at here, but you don't get them delved into. Like, they don't really even explain why Newt got expelled from or dismissed from Hogwarts.
They did. They made a point of saying that in the trailer. Do you think they'd pay that off?
Basically, all they say is that he was excused and that Dumbledore went to bat for him. That's about it. So, I mean, they introduce a love interest for Newt that we now know is going to be in future movies. A past girlfriend, an ex, a flame. And it's like, okay, maybe that relationship can add some shading to his character. But how is it going to inform the greater narrative? You know, it's just one of those things where if this is a standalone movie, yeah, it works. It's great. He gets back on the boat. He goes back to England. He writes his memoirs and he comes back to America and he gives them to this girl that he met and life is happily ever after. But when you're four movies down the line...
Yeah. I don't know. Hopefully there's some, they look at the movie like truthfully and be like, okay, so we say we're going to make all these movies, but we need to do this too. Or they can do what Warner Brothers is known to do, just be like, money, go. Which is...
Well, she's a strong writer, and she will learn as she goes. My concern is, if I continue not caring about Newt, and only care about the Dumbledore-Grindelwald prequel element of this, I don't need Newt there. I don't need magical creatures. I just need a freaking Grindelwald-Dumbledore leading up to the Battle of 1945 prequel. With people like McGonagall and like Dumbledore and like Mad-Eye Moody, characters from the Harry Potter world who would populate that story of Dumbledore and Grindelwald. If you want to do a Dumbledore and Grindelwald prequel trilogy, I'm down. But that's not what you sold me when you started this endeavor. You sold me on, we're going to take this little bestiary and we're going to tell you the story of this author. Now it's become, we're going to take this little bestiary and we're going to tell you the story about its author, who was a key part of the events that led up to this great Wizarding Battle of 1945. Which in and of itself is first mentioned in the very first book on the back of Dumbledore's chocolate frog card, and really explored more and never explored in depth, and only hinted at throughout the rest of the books.
So, well, I think we're going to get it. But I think it's going to be wrapped in these movies.
Yeah, that's, if I'm Warner Brothers, and of course, I'm sure they've sat down and had a conversation with Rowling, but if I'm Warner Brothers, what do I keep calling these movies if Newt's not going to be a large part, if he's just going to be a person who is present while these events are going on, and these events are going on around him as he's doing his other things, why does he need to be there? Yeah.
Well, the good thing is, even if they want to go in that direction and wrap these movies in it, I don't think they would unless that's what Rowling wants to do.
Well, and that's the thing. Like, I feel almost as if the story of Newt, I keep trying to call him Nate, the story of Newt, I think all of this honestly just started as Warner Brothers saying, hey, look, we've been trying to replace Potter money since 2011 when all of this went away. We need Potter money. This is an idea that we can run with. Which was silly because to me, I've said it many times on this podcast and other places, you could take the tales of Beedle the Bard, and each one of those tales is a fairy tale from the Wizarding World, and you could have done anthology movies of these stories, starting with the Tale of the Three Brothers, which is, of course, the story that revolves around the Deathly Hallows.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I think they were just like, we need Potter money, and this is a way to do Potter money, and then they got Rowling creatively involved, and Rowling was like, as she does, because she's a great mind, she has this entire world that she envisions, and she plots out this huge story. And, you know, we can't see the forest through the trees. We don't know where she's going to take things as she goes. There's obvious threads that are left to be picked up in a sequel, but my thought, again, is I'm perfectly okay with you saying, I want to do a Dumbledore, Grindelwald-centric prequel trilogy. Because we want to talk about that. Deal with the Hallows. We want to deal with Dumbledore's relationship with his sister Ariana. We want to deal with his relationship with Aberforth. We want to deal with his relationship with Grindelwald. We want to deal with how he became the man that we see in Sorcerer's Stone. And we want to do what the text of Half-Blood Prince and Deathly Hallows does, which is throw tremendous shades of gray in a character who had been so black and white.
Yeah.
I'm okay with that. You don't need the Beast, and you don't need Newt, and you don't need his little love story with Lita Lestrange, to tie all that together.
I'd agree. But, I think at this point we just have to kind of see where they're going to take it.
Well, I mean, they're going to trank them out. Next one's scheduled for 2018, November.
2018?
November of 2018.
So that means you have to start shooting next year.
And Yates is coming back, so.
Yeah, I haven't seen it yet. I like David Yates, but it might be time to, like, move on down.
I don't think there's much difference. I think for this, I know they were talking to Caron, and he wanted to do something smaller after Gravity.
Okay, can't blame him.
But that is, Azkaban is without a doubt the most visually striking of all of these movies, and it becomes really the bridge between Yates and Columbus, really. I don't necessarily know that a unique directorial vision is going to really change the way that we perceive that Wizarding World, because so much of his vision of it is the way that we interpret it. I mean, he did 6 movies. He's done 6 Harry Potter movies now.
See, I don't think the voice or visually what we'll see will change that much. But just for him, it's 6 movies that...
Well, he's already said, like, I'm down to do this. I'm like, Joe wants to do 4 more of these, I'll do 4 more of these. I don't care.
I know he said that. And I know he has all the intention in the world of making good things. But after a while, it's just like, it's got to be like...
Kind of like Zach.
Yeah.
I mean, Zach has been working on DC movies and nothing but DC movies since 2011. So, you know, here we are about to enter 2017. That's a large chunk of time to be spending with one set of source material.
Yeah, at some point you just need to, like, step away.
And I think some of that, too, is just the comfort level that Rowling has with Yates having worked on the Potter films and developing that kind of shorthand and rapport, so.
I agree.
So, let's move on. We got as part of the Fantastic Beasts release, we got a new Wonder Woman trailer. Your thoughts on that? Not too much different.
But, you know, it's still... It gives you good feelings about the movie. But when it comes to DC, we've always gotten good trailers. The fan reception to the actual movie is a lot different. So, I like the trailer. I'm still But nothing's changed. I'm still concerned about Gal. I don't think she'll bomb by any means, but she still has to carry this movie. Granted, they've put everything in place so she can get carried to a good movie. She just has to, like, not Goldberg it, not sell them, and she should be fine. But how much of this... Is the tone really different? Is the story good? Those are the questions. Trailers make me feel good. It is Patty Jenkins, so that makes me feel good too. But still, you have to see the final result.
And if it's, again, you just don't... I don't understand, or I don't really know what standardized expectations should be for a summer release now. Just mainly because summer is literally, you tend to have a week to 2 weeks to yourself to make as much money as you possibly can. So what it is, unless your name is Marvel or Star Wars or Pixar or Illumination frequently, what is reasonable? I mean, the winner of the first Avenger money was 200, right around 198, 200 million. I don't know that you can get away with doing that domestically for a Wonder Woman movie.
No. Reasonable for a Wonder Woman movie, I would think, would be around Man of Steel numbers.
Which, by the way, Suicide Squad finally ended its domestic run exactly $5 million behind Dawn of Justice.
Dawn of Justice, the movie I just can't quit.
Think about that. A movie that just barely has the Joker in it and has Harley Quinn, who people are just barely cognizant of, made just $5 million less than Dawn of Justice, which had Batman, Superman, and the first on-screen appearance of Wonder Woman.
But the difference is, people of the two films, people think Suicide Squad is fun. I think Batman vs. Superman is a better movie than Suicide Squad, but I've only seen Suicide Squad once, but I would say that it's more fun than Batman vs. Superman, which I've seen more times than I really should have. And people resonate with the fun. It's like people want to go to DC movies and they want to have fun. And Suicide Squad was the first one was like, here, peekaboo, fun. I'm going to close it real quick, but you can glance at it. So, Wonder Woman just has to, like, at this point, it has to get decent reviews. I would say good, but I'm willing to crawl before I walk. At least decent reviews. Decent reviews, and it makes Man of Steel money. Everybody's okay. Good reviews of Man of Steel money. Everybody's like, happy.
And it takes the pressure off going in a little bit going into Justice League the following November.
They need to take pressure off of that, because even though I do think they changed Justice League a lot from releasing Batman vs. Superman until whatever we're going to get now. And I'm not as hard on Zach for Man of Steel as a lot of people. I am hard on Zach for Batman vs. Superman, even though I can't stop watching that crap. But it's still Zach. And I know it's going to look good, but I have no clue about the rest. I know I like the cast.
I mean, this is the first of the Geoff Johns run.
You would think this would officially be the one. I know...
Yeah, this is the one that they're pushing out there as, hey, he had full creative input and control. And
I think they're pushing it with Wonder Woman 2, and I think he had more control, more input on Wonder Woman. But I don't know how much control he had.
I'll be interested to see what the narrative ends up being, because we've both been under the assumption for a while that dude's dead man walking. Like, as soon as Justice League Part 1 is over, that they'll dismiss him and they'll bring somebody else in for Justice League 2.
They won't dismiss him. Zach is too much of a... too much of a good guy.
But again, that comes back to what you were just talking about with David Yates. You know, Zack Snyder is, by definition, the tone of the DCCU. DCEU. He birthed it with Man of Steel. He doubled down on it in Dawn of Justice. he was giving David Ayer notes on Suicide Squad. You know, he's had an idea of what he wanted Justice League to be. He finally got the freaking death of Superman done on screen. We're going to get the resurrection of Superman in Justice League. I mean, you can put all the, like, I'd argue that, yes, interactions between the Flash and anybody, especially Cyborg, but anybody, are going to be light, fun, and campy.
Mm-hmm.
If you just show me clips of Bruce Banner, of Bruce Wayne and Barry Allen going back and forth, yeah, that's going to be lighthearted, fun, and campy. Show me interactions between Wonder Woman and Bruce Wayne, Diana Prince and Bruce Wayne. Show me more intense interactions between him and Aquaman, because I think those are more informative of what the whole is going to be.
So, I think what it comes down to is, from what we've seen in The Flash, I do think you're right. Flash is going to be lighter than everybody else.
Although he can't get off the ground with his own movie, but...
I think that'll change. It has to change before Justice League.
Do you think it's possible that they're playing the waiting game to see if Lord Miller will come back around to actually direct?
No. If they want to keep any sort of semblance of their timetable, they can't. Because Lord Miller's going to start working on Han Solo like next year.
February.
Yeah, and it comes out in 2018. That means they're booked until then. They want that movie to come out in 2018-19. They can't wait on him. I mean, it's sad.
They can ask him to do another pass on a story or pass on a script.
They could, but they're not. But they have to know they're doing a Star Wars movie. And not just any Star Wars movie. They're doing Han Solo. They're not doing nothing for none of y'all until this is done.
And if they can pull this off, they go directly to Hollywood Hall of Fame.
They can write their... I mean, they're borderline can write whatever check they want right now. But after that, it's like, what do you want? We've made everything successful. Just we will only select what we want now. So none of you. But, I mean, I would like to see it. I just don't think they can wait. But So Flash is going to be like... He'll be a change of pace and everybody's going to like him. Again, I know I'm a big fan of Superman, but it comes down to how is Superman treated in this movie. The fact that he can take Flash and even from what we've seen, make him lighter than everybody else in the room and so he can change the tone on one character. So can he finally do that with Superman? Who doesn't have to be the Flash, but he just has to not be what he's been, particularly in Batman vs. Superman.
No more moping around and being sad.
Like, you can... Superman doesn't have to be serious, but if you see...
Look at Lois and Clark.
Like, that Superman is fine. He's like, he's stern, but not like, just like, dour and depressed and all this stuff. All you have to do is let Henry Cavill be Henry Cavill. Watch anything the dude does that is not Superman. It's like, I see why that dude is Superman. They slap the suit on him, and anytime that he's in the suit and not filming the movie, everybody's like, that is Superman. The minute Zach steps in front of the camera and says, action, what is this? So just everywhere else, just do that. That's all you got to do. He can be pissed off when he comes back from the dead. He just died. But after that, Superman. Just do Superman. It's not that hard.
Apparently it is, Chad.
I don't have any problems with Man of Steel, the portrayal there. But it's like, he had a reason to be this mad in Man of Steel. And this one is just like, nope. Everybody's against him. And he's just going to be like, well, why the hell are y'all against me? And I'm just going to hang my head. But just let Henry Cavill be Henry Cavill. It's easy as that.
You know, they could just rock everybody's complete world and say that a funny thing happened in that bathtub in Dawn of Justice.
No. Look. We got rid of Superman Returns for Super Babies. We don't need any more right now. Even though he has a kid in the comic run right now and I'm rather enjoying it. But we don't need a Super Baby right now. Because I don't know this Superman. He's not a Superman I want him to be. Let's get him there first. Then he can have kids. Like 10 years later.
All right. So, Chad, while we were discussing Warner Brothers properties, a new Lego Batman trailer and poster and advertisements of all sorts have started hitting the web in anticipation of the February release date. Your thoughts on the new marketing materials for the Lego Batman movie? In the news that Billy Dee Williams will be finally getting his chance to Two-Face.
I'm glad you brought that up. I will get to that last. But I am glad I have a kid so I can go into these type of movies and people don't look at me funny, because I'm more excited than she is. And she's fairly excited to see this movie. This last trailer, it made me smile the whole way through. The explanation of Robin's suit and the lines between Batman and the Joker about not having a steady villain and he's just fighting around kind of thing. My kid doesn't get it. I'm laughing hysterically. There's no reason I should be looking forward to a Lego Batman movie. There's no reason I should be looking forward to a Lego movie. I just can't wait to see this. And it goes to show that you can do a whole lot with just the name Batman and people will see it. And you can go this completely corny, campy route and everybody's like, it's still Batman. And it's still fun, and they're just ready to see it. So I'm ready to see it. I'm really eager for that weekend, because it's like that. It's Batman and the masochist movie.
50 Shades of Grey.
Yeah, and there's
50 Shades of Darker.
50 Shades Darker, and there's another movie that comes out that weekend too that I will be inclined to go see, but I can't remember. So I'm curious to see what will win the weekend. I might have to look up what the other movie is. But Billy Dee Williams. So, if for people that don't know,
Batman 89.
Yeah, in Batman 89, Billy Dee Williams was in that movie, and he played Harvey Dent.
Which was a big deal at the time, because it was a black man playing Harvey Dent.
Yeah, even as a kid, I was like, oh! And as a kid, I knew who Billy Dee Williams was, and I knew who Harvey Dent was. So the first thing I thought was, oh, he's going to be Two-Face. And that was the main reason Billy Dee Williams signed up to have that role was so he could become Two-Face. So, years later, they replaced him with Tommy Lee Jones. So, Billy Dee never got to pull off his Two-Face.
Which was fair, because Schumacher's films were... I don't even know that Warner's was trying to say that they were set in the same universe.
They were, well, they're supposed to be, because there's the reference in there... Nicole Kidman's character makes to him about, can I see you anytime, or do I have to be wearing like whatever Catwoman wears, something like that. So it's supposed to be in the same world, but there's nothing.
There, you cannot get two different movies than Batman Forever and Batman Returns.
Man, God, this Batman Returns is what is pure unadulterated burden in.
No, no, sir. Mars Attacks is pure unadulterated burden.
But I like that one. And I don't dislike Returns, but like this is pure unadulterated burden with a property that's... Mars Attacks is not his either, but he can do more things with that. This is like a character that people know, and he's just like, yep, I'm just going to do whatever I want with this, and y'all just going to like it. And the executives are like, but bro, we can't sell toys. What are you doing? What are you doing?
You get a villain who rides a rubber ducky.
Which is a great toy, and they made that toy. But the villain, who is wearing, you know, a onesie that's basically mildew because he lives in the sewer and he's bitten up green stuff with freaking flippers and stuff. What kid wants that?
Next to a Catwoman who is...
She's a dominatrix. Out of the two of those villains... One of those got a movie-accurate toy, and it wasn't a penguin. They were like, okay, we can work with the Catwoman. This penguin thing that you got here, we are not making toys for this at all. It was the straight-up old Burgess Meredith penguin with the top hat and stuff. They were like, forget this. Mutant Penguin stays out of this. But that was a long tangent. to get back to Billy Dee Williams being Two-Face. But Billy Dee Williams finally gets to be Two-Face in the Lego Batman movie. I didn't know Two-Face was in this. So it's a nice nod to people that know what happened. Nice way for Billy Dee to finally come back around and get that Two-Face nod. And as I think about it, because as a kid I didn't. You know, Billy Dee is known for his smooth and docile tones, and now he's going to be playing Two-Face, who I don't really think of docile tones when I think of Two-Face.
Then you don't normally think over-the-top acting when you think Tommy Lee Jones.
Normally, no, but that's sure in hell what we got.
You have to admit, that's perfect casting for Carrie at that point in his career, in 96. In 95, 96, that's perfect casting for Jim Carrey, and he does the role really well.
It depends on what you think of the Riddler. From the comics, he's more of a...
The comics are more, I think, in line with what they're doing on Gotham. Of a kind of pragmatic guy who likes puzzles, who just eventually becomes whatever.
Yeah, but he's like really smart with it, yeah.
Right. But I think, like, what Carrie was channeling was pure Adam West.
Yeah, it was
Batman.
What, Frank Gorshin?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was Frank Gorshin, like, cranked to 11 and bouncing all over the place. Which is fine, and it does fit Jim Carrey.
And it fit the tone of that movie.
It does, but I would say it takes the tone of that movie a little overboard. Like, Two-Face is over the top in that movie. Until he's over the top, but just like an acceptable range of crazy over the top that kind of fits.
A guy whose face is half burned off and he's running around with prostitutes.
Yeah, did he? Yes, he did. But that it all fits for how the beginning of that movie goes. But then when the Riddler shows up, everybody's just like, nope, we gotta go over the edge. And that's when Tommy Lee starts hamming it up. The second Jim Carrey starts the inkling of he wants to be the Riddler, and then Two-Face shows up at the circus around the same time that happens, and Tommy Lee is just hamming it up from that point all the way to the end of the movie. I'm about to watch this crap soon.
It gave us the greatest Seal song of all time.
It did, and I watched that song a whole lot. Because, you know, back in the day, you young people that don't remember stuff, to get like glimpses of a movie before it came out, you had to watch the music videos. So I watched Kiss from a Rose a whole lot.
Yes. So let's move on from our Warner Brothers material, and let's talk about Rogue One, which is now tracking numbers at 130 million. It is now the second fastest selling pre-sale ticket in history behind Force Awakens, and is on track for the second biggest December opening, the first being The Force Awakens. Your thoughts, sir, on Rogue One, A Star Wars Story, the anticipation level, and the fact that, you know, Disney's already on record as saying they don't expect 218 million.
Well, they shouldn't expect 218 million because that is absurd, and I've seen
and... And I don't even believe Episode 8 will be able to...
I don't think it's going to get that either. But 130 sounds low to me. It makes sense that it's the second highest...
by a mile. I mean, before we got to last year's Force Awakens, the leader in the clubhouse was the first Hobbit movie, which opened at like 82 million.
Yeah, that...
So, like, to go from 82 million to 220.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
That they did. Like, that's a large difference. Almost as big as the difference between Episode 7 and Sisters.
It'll be over 130. I'm thinking maybe 160, 170.
I would argue that, honestly, Age of Ultron's a good target at 182.
182. And
that was a disappointment because everybody was expecting it.
Yeah, it was like the 220. We all thought it was going to be over 200. I think 180 is a little bit too high, mostly because it's December, and it's not an episode film. And I still think you're going to have to tell, like, I think the collective conscience around this movie is, okay, it's not an episode movie. I still don't think people really understand, like, exactly where it is.
Which is an interesting conversation I had with a friend of mine this past week, which was, you know, episodes 8 comes out a year from now. It's in the can, been in the can for a while. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've got to drop footage at some point. Are you going to really play around until Celebration in Orlando in April? I mean, that seems to be a long time to go without showing anything. But at the same time, if you attach a short Episode 8 trailer to Rogue One, does that throw the audience off?
Yeah.
Because you've already announced that you're not doing an opening crawl.
Yeah, have you heard what the opening is supposed to be?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a tough spot, because the best movie before you release the first trailer in front of would be Rogue One. But, again, we know that this is an episode film. I think the general audience knows it's not an episode film, but they don't understand where it takes place. And then you throw an actual episode trailer in front, they might be like, well, what the hell am I watching here?
But they've already got your ticket.
Yeah, you're in the hole now. It's too late. And then there are already so many other trailers that are about to be attached to this thing. I don't know which one.
Michael Bay's Transformers The Last Night.
I completely forgot about it. I thought I'd get out of here without a mention of that. But no, you have to just, you know, throw it in my face.
Churchill, Nazis, King Arthur, Guinevere.
I'm praying that they don't have that in front of the Rogue One when we go see it. Because there's so many other trailers coming. We got Justice League, that crap, and Spider-Man at least in front of it. And I would have to, and probably Guardians too. And Guardians or Spider-Man is going to be the one that's like regularly attached to it. I'm hoping Transformers get bumped out of whichever one we go see. That's too bad. So you have, I know Spider-Man is Sony, but in this case, we're just going to say it's Disney. So we got two Disney movies getting trailers attached to it. Are they really going to throw a third one? And as far as I know, there's only one that's like attached to all of them.
Well, the question mark for me is, look, we're a year out. November of 2014 is when they did the first 30-second spot for Force Awakens. We didn't get the title Force Awakens until like after the first of the year of 2015. You've got Celebration built in. You know they're going to do things at Celebration in Orlando. Can they really afford to wait till April? I mean, we had this conversation with JJ almost immediately after he took the job, which was like, how long can you keep the mystery box going? And, you know, they gave us like two trailers and that was it.
Yeah.
One in November and one in April.
I think we'll get more than two, but I don't think we'll get more than three.
No, we got three. Because we got the Celebration trailer, Chewie, we're home. We got the Rey popping up out, Finn popping up out of the desert in November. We got Chewie, we're home. And then we got the spot during the Giants game.
When they
announced tickets were going on.
Okay. But yeah, so that's just three. I think that's the same three we'll get this time.
But if you follow that timeline, that's November, April, and October.
So we've already passed November. So, it makes all the sense in the world. It's just, I don't know if they're going to do it. But if that's the case, then they would have to attach it. I know in this day and age, everything drops online first, but you still attach it to a movie. And the next big Disney movie after that is March. It's Beauty and the Beast. So are they going to actually wait?
If you're going to wait till March, why not wait another 4 weeks?
When is Celebration?
The weekend, 2 weeks after Mania. So Mania is the first Sunday in April. Celebration's 2 weeks after that.
Yeah, it's not close enough. It would have to
They're be. Both in Orlando, but they're 2 weeks apart.
So, yeah, that...
And they're doing it at the convention, and as far as I know, they're doing it at the convention center. They're not doing it on Disney on Disney's property.
I don't know why not. That's just like a whole freaking city. Yeah, Beauty and the Beast is too far out from Celebration. So, I mean, really, they should really just do it now. And then you get the second one. I mean, do a teaser that's nothing but, you know, you see Luke do something. Literally see Luke come out.
Luke ignite the lightsaber and say a line of dialogue.
And that's it. That's it. That's all you got to do.
Yeah.
And do that, and then at Celebration you get the first trailer. I don't think that's going to happen.
You could go with that new line of dialogue that's been rumored about, you know, the spark within or whatever. I mean, I think it makes all the sense in the world before a Star Wars story, Rogue One, to do the Episode 8 trailer and then come back in April and do a trailer at Celebration and sometime between Celebration and the trailer release to do a title.
Oh yeah, we still haven't got the title, so... I mean,
because we know that they're dropping the episodes.
Yeah.
They're not gonna... It wasn't Episode 7. Star Wars Episode 7.
Force Awakens.
The Force Awakens. It was just Star Wars: The Force Awakens. So this will be Star Wars:
Raise Luke's love child. On a completely just frivolous matter with this. Does Luke keep that green lightsaber? Or does he go to a blue one?
See, the feeling that I've gotten and from what I've seen of production stills, it looks like that's going to become Daisy's. Anakin's lightsaber is going to get passed to Daisy and used by Daisy. We already broke the one person wielding a lightsaber tradition in Empire Strikes Back where Han has to use it to open the Tauntaun. Yeah. And then Finn having to pick it up and use it against Kylo in Episode 7. But traditionally, one Jedi, one lightsaber, and I think that they're going to pass that blue lightsaber on to Rey.
I'm pretty sure, because all the... Because
clearly he hasn't seen that lightsaber in 30 years.
Yeah, yeah.
As far as he's concerned, it went down a hole, and...
Where's my hand, bro?
Yeah.
But all the, like...
There was a hand with that.
If you buy a blue lightsaber now, if you buy a blue lightsaber now, the toy ones, they all say Rey's lightsaber, and they don't say anything about Luke. So I don't think he's taking that one back. It's just, I'm just thinking about...
The rest of the story, kind of like, here's your lightsaber back. I haven't seen that in years. Let me tell you the story of it.
Well...
I mean, Masquinado said it's a very interesting story. She'll tell us again sometime.
Yeah, I do want to hear that story. But I'm just, my mind has Luke as we saw him, but then him having that green lightsaber from Jedi, and I'm like, that looks stupid in my mind. And I've seen, and looking at his green lightsaber, I don't like it. I just don't like the hand.
But it could be done a whole lot better now with CGI and computer graphics.
Oh, no, it's not it's just the color of the blade. Well, what he's wearing, and I guess it's because this is where the prequels bleed in. Because there was not our Jedi's that we followed through most of that were all wearing stuff like Luke, but most of them didn't have green lightsabers; they had blue ones. So it just looks
purple.
Better. Or if you're mace, you're purple. But most of them, the blue just kind of looked better with it. So
and Yoda's lightsaber is green, but that
kind of blends in with him because he's green. So Luke wearing traditional Jedi garb just looks to me like you have a blue lightsaber, not a green one. I don't mind the green one, just not what we're
wearing. As long as you're wearing dark clothing.
Yeah, if you're wearing all black, fine. I do want him to get a new handle, because I decided I hate his handle from Jedi. I just don't like it.
Well, he built it himself, so.
I know, and it was his first one, so that's why it looks stupid.
So one more Star Wars note. What do you make of the latest rumor, the reason that we haven't delved into a Obi-Wan Kenobi solo movie is the fact that... They're gonna bring Ian McGregor back for episodes 8 and 9. Door's wide open. We had this whole discussion about Force Ghost and about, you know, Hayden Christensen possibly having to come back because of what Lucas did. But Force Ghosting it, and if Luke's gonna have a conversation with Obi-Wan, you know, Alan Guinness has been dead for 16 years. You know, the incarnation that everybody knows and loves is McGregor's. So if he's going to have a conversation with the Force Ghosts of Obi-Wan the way that he did in episodes 5 and 6, it's got to be McGregor.
So I was all on board with him being a Force Ghost until you said Hayden Christensen. And I was like, that's right, because Anakin's dead too, and we get Hayden Christensen Ghost. No. I don't. If I have to have a Hayden Christensen Ghost to get an Obi-Wan Ghost, I don't want either one of them.
Well, see, I don't think they're going to go that route. I don't think you would show a conversation between Luke and his father. Because I think they're like, even though they're 30 years that have passed, I would assume that at some point he had a Force Ghost conversation with his father to kind of work out some of his daddy issues that he had.
So Obi-Wan's Force Ghost shows up. The audience is going to be like, well, why can't... Because undoubtedly, they're going to have to say something about Vader.
I mean, and there's potentially, you know, those rumors have been out there for a while about Yoda and Frank Oz being spotted on set and this, that, and the other thing. Completely, again, plausible that you could do Force Ghost Yoda.
But
the precedent's already been set in both Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi for having extended conversation with Force Ghost.
But the more Force Ghost you have, the more likely it is you have to bring in Anakin at some point. And I don't want that. That is the only thing. I think they will run around it in circles and not have
The only person I could see trying to communicate with the Force Ghost of Obi-Wan Kenobi would be this guy right here, Kylo Ren. Because, I mean, he's a Vader fanboy. And if he... If he's been able to channel the Force enough to mind-meld people...
I mean, but dude... Like, just watching the movies, it just seems like the Force Ghost show up and talk to whoever they want to. Granted, that's always Luke. But, it just seems like they kind of, like...
Well,
you know,
I mean, the rule... The way that Yoda's very specific about it at the end of Revenge of the Sith. He explains that Qui-Gon was the one who found a way to come back. And Qui-Gon explained to Yoda how he figured out how to do it. And Yoda and Obi-Wan communed with Qui-Gon in the 18-year period between Revenge of the Sith and A New Hope to figure out how to achieve that. That's why when he faces Vader, he can hold up his lightsaber and have this moment of meditation and get chopped and become more powerful than Vader can ever imagine. Because he's figured out how to become a Force Ghost.
So I would almost buy that, but then there's...
Well, that's what's set out in canon. That's Yoda's line at the end of Jedi is an old friend has come back at the end of Revenge of the Sith. An old friend has come back and he has taught me how to do it. And he will teach you too.
Okay. So, Qui-Gon taught Obi-Wan and Yoda. So, this is fine until we get to Return of the Jedi. And there's Anakin standing there. Who, as far as I know, shouldn't know how to do it.
Unless the way that it is done is just through your spirit. A ghost, the implication is ghost, so assuming that that's your Jedi spirit, in a way, that would you know, be the spiritual representation of the Jedi that was within you. But then again, that goes back to the whole conversation that we have about Vader died, Anakin died as a 55, 60-year-old man. He didn't die as a 18-year-old emo kid.
Yeah. So all in all,
I'm down with it. I want Ewan McGregor to have a conversation with Mark Hamill as part of trying to figure out Rey's parentage or whatever.
I think it would be cool. I like Ewan McGregor as Obi-Wan. I want more of it.
And he's been totally on board to come back.
Yep. It's just if any part of that clause about Force Ghost contains Anakin Skywalker, I don't want nothing to do with it. Get it all. Get rid of it all.
Hey, I mean, you never know. I mean, Hayden could have been spending this entire time trying to figure out a way to redeem himself.
It's not even so much... I mean, it is him, But it's not so much that I don't think he's gotten better as an actor. Even if he didn't, I think that he will have better direction, because all of these directors, no offense to George, aren't going to be better than George at these directing.
At working with people.
Yes. But it's the whole stigma that comes with him, because that, I mean, part of the reason he had, I'm imagining it's hard for him to get work, is that people see him as Anakin Skywalker that nobody liked.
Emo Skywalker.
Yes. So,
Anakin, you're breaking my heart.
So imagine we're sitting there and Obi-Wan Force Ghost shows up and everybody's like, yeah. And then the minute he would step on the screen, if people would have tomatoes, they would throw them at the screen. Even if it's their first time seeing the movie, they'd blow it up until that point. Just because it's him. He could be great.
He's the representation of the prequels.
It's like Jar Jar Binks, the little kid Anakin, and him. They are what people think of the prequels, and they hate them all.
Well, I mean, we've already blown up Coruscant, so. Which, again, it's amazing to me. We are over a year out from just about a year away from this movie, and Abrams has not ever gone into detail about, oh, by the way, I blew up the core world.
No.
I blew up the Senate, blew up Mon Mothra, blew up Jar Jar Binks, just blew up the core of the entire universe. So once we get done with question time with Mr. Feige, we can move to question time with Mr. Abrams.
I think you'd have better luck with Feige.
Well, we will see. So as we get closer to Rogue One, of course, we'll be having more stories about that. We are both looking forward to our first look at the Freaks and Geeks. John Hughes tone that will come with the Spider-Man Homecoming movie, and our first look at Zendaya and web wings and the whole nine yards, and figuring out whether or not Uncle Ben's actually in the movie. And so we'll have more things to discuss as we go along. I did not, however, want to leave our podcast audience lingering. As you know, on the last few episodes that I've posted, I have referred to a show called Red Oaks, which finally had its debut, and due to some internet problems that I've had transitioning between places of establishment, or homes of abode, as one might say, it took me a while to get through the entire thing. So let me give my commentary on Red Oaks Season 2. This is now starting to feel much, much, much more like a Soderbergh-esque bio, which I'm not really down with. I like the idea of this being just a random kid from Jersey in the 80s. I don't need it to, you know, have overtones of Soderbergh's career when it started off. You know, I didn't need that. Second, they missed the boat on tone. They went a whole lot more serious and for more of the dramatic tones of the dramedy, and went lighter on the comedy. The comedic elements are more welcome when they show up because they're fewer and further between. We don't spend as much time at the club as we did in the first season. Now, granted, dealing with heavier themes, you know, Getty's trial for racketeering or for insider trading, Sky and David's parents' divorce, and his mother's potential lesbian sexual exploration, David and Sky's relationship, Sky's own inner battles that she has throughout the entire thing, David's evolution of who he is and what he wants to do with his life. But they leaned more heavy on the dramatic than the comedic, and I felt that was a disservice to the material. I also think that they didn't focus as much on some of the side characters as they could have, and they didn't develop arcs well enough this go around. I think it was good to focus on Skye and David and flush out their stories a lot more, because they're the centerpiece of the show. But at the same time, the fact that David's most immediate ex-girlfriend, a year later, after they break up, is getting married to the guy that he left her for, that she left him for, should be something that's talked about and explained, he should emote and work through those emotions. He's so busy dealing with 1,500 other things that kind of gets pushed to the side. And it's a very sweet moment what he does to help his ex, but it kind of just feels doesn't have as much weight and depth as it could have. The comedic elements are well done. Paul Reiser, fantastic as Getty. I didn't like them pairing up David and Getty as much as they did, because it felt like it took away from Skye and David time, which I thought was more interesting and better. And how David and Asher's time together was more interesting. And what they and this whole sidebar that they did with Asher didn't really make sense to me, that all of a sudden, a year after the last time we see Asher in season one, he's getting in his new car that he bought with his wife, and he's happily married and kissing, and, you know, I've got a future, you know? And then we come back a year later, and it's like they're making jokes about the ex-wife giving him chlamydia, and, like, they're divorced now and good riddance, and he just is moving on to trying to find a rich widow at the club to hook up with. And it's like, it doesn't ring true of where you left that character in season one. That there would be so much that would have had to have happened off screen in the time between the two seasons to even think about justifying the divorce. And the divorce completely changes the dynamic of that character. And it's just, there were character development choices, there were aesthetic choices. One of my favorite episodes actually was the genre trappings episode. You know, they did the body switch episode in season one. They did the road trip movie in season two, Those I liked, but I just felt like they were looking around at everything that was going on Amazon and going, hey, wait, we're on a streaming service which has a whole bunch of very serious material dealing with very serious social issues and equal justice issues and things like that. We need to make statements. We don't need to be just fun and camp. And I think there is definitely a borderline there between Freaks and Geeks and Wet Hot American Summer, that you can find that balance in between the two. And I felt like they straddled that balance really well in season one. I didn't think they did so well in season two. And because Amazon, just like Netflix, doesn't release their subscriber counts or their viewership numbers, it took them 2 months to come out and announce a season two for Red Oaks the first time. I'm wondering if they're going to have a season three. It ends at a resting place where you're left to kind of fill in the blanks in your own head, and sometimes TV series work best that way when they end. But I mean, I know that Carter Bays and Thomas on How I Met Your Mother, for the first three seasons, they were on year-to-year deals, so they always left Ted with somebody at the end of the season in case that the show ended, they could just throw the tagline on that was the mother. Well, once you start operating on two-year deals, you could plan further out. It doesn't seem to me they've had assurances that there's going to be a season three. And I'm okay with where things end. But all in all, I just think they leaned too heavy into the dramatic and not on the comedic. And I think they did a disservice to their material by doing that.
Maybe I'll watch it now.
It's fantastic television. It's a really fantastic show that I love a lot. I just think that they were like, look, some of our better elements of season one were some of our dramatic attempts, dramatic messages that we were and notes that we were hitting, and we're on a streaming service, and we have all these other various dark, serious things around us, maybe we need to be doing some of that. And part of it is just life. I mean, life isn't always a bright, sunny walk in the park. But at the same time, you are a, by definition, a sitcom. And so you should be, well, you can certainly use that platform for commentary and for dramatic purposes. I think you should never lose the heart and never lose the fun of what made you great. And, or what makes you a comedy. And I feel like at times in this season, they lose that heart. And I think that was disconcerting to me.
Enough.
So, that'll do it for my review of Red Oak Season 2.
One more thing.
Okay.
That just happened. Okay. So, we now know...
Da-da-da! Breaking news!
Yeah, we now know what movie is coming out for WBDC on October 5th of 2018.
Okay, so that's some other news that we didn't cover. Fox Marvel put out some extra release dates. Everybody's trying to guess which one's Deadpool 2, which one's X-Force, and which one's Deadpool 3.
Yeah, I have no idea about any of those. I would just imagine X-Force is after Deadpool 3. But all of those dates are kind of close to each other to be
Deadpool. And one of them has to be New Mutants, and one of them has to be Deadpool 2 for sure.
Yeah.
Because Gambit's off the table, and X-Men's off the table for now. So.
Good riddance. But the DC...
Which you'll be happy to know X-Men Apocalypse is ending up on a bunch of worst movies of 2016 list.
As it should. As it should. But the October 15th, the October 5th, 2018 release is...
The Batman.
Aquaman.
Ah.
They moved it from July or whatever.
June. Yeah.
Yeah, they moved it to...
Again, it's hard for me to remember their dates because they announced them on a conference call. I can't go on YouTube and watch their announcement via the conference call.
I always remember that date because once they announced it, everybody was like, it's October, everybody likes Batman, this is going to be Batman. But by moving that there, and Batman always seems to be a summer movie, are they going to put Batman on that June date?
Again, it's just going to be interesting to see how he balances everything out, because he's going to be Live by Night is still not, hasn't come across on the award circuit really yet.
No, the limited release is like next week.
Yeah, and it should start screening for critics, and once it does, then we'll have a better idea of his directorial chances in that category. But again, I mean, he's just finished filming Justice League. They decided not to film them both back-to-back. Yeah. They just filmed the one. And he still has to write. Last I heard, when he was on the accountant press tour, he said that they hadn't finished the script yet.
But everybody that's supposed to be in it is like, they're saying the dates range from March to, like, May.
Yeah, see, we've got Alfred and we've got Mangiello.
They both said different dates.
Yeah.
But
Would make sense because they could have...
Different schedules, yeah.
Right.
So, the movie's going to shoot next year sometime. And if it shoots between March and... I would probably say it's probably will start in like April, just to give him time to come off of the press tour for Live by Night and do the Oscars and all that stuff, and then have like a month cushion. And then start that. So they started shooting it in, let's say, April. They'll be done by, what, August at the latest? And that's almost a full year to do post-production on it. So it could theoretically be on that June date.
It could indeed. So that'll about do it for this week's episode of the Movies on the Brain podcast. If you want to keep up with this podcast, you can follow me on Twitter at BCWTigerFan.
And I'm at The Mist Theory.
Thank you very much, and have a pleasant evening.